A lot of us come to Christ for different reasons, and in my mind, there are sort of two types of people that respond to Christ. You know, not everybody's responsive, depending on where we're at in our lives, and it doesn't mean that we're unresponsive people or we don't register need for God. It has to do sometimes with a certain feeling of vulnerability, and then the grace to come out of denial about that vulnerability, and then we acknowledge that, oh my goodness, I need some help. My wheels are coming off. And so there are some of us who just run to Christ in just desperation. We so need him, and there's a beautiful brokenness and humility, and we've got a sweet experience with Christ, you know. Everything's wonderful. We are profoundly grateful. And then there's the other crowd. Our lives are sort of okay, but we're drawn toward the ideal. And if we didn't become Christians, then we'd be running around with the fees must fall and the fleas must fall, and you know, something. We've got to do something. We're always reaching for some kind of sense of significance, and you want to leave your fingerprint, your mark on the world. You sort of go through life like a spiritual dog. You know, you can't pass a tree without telling the tree I was here. Some of us are a little bit like that, and we're always reaching for that ephemeral something out there somewhere, isn't that so? Like, I'm one of them, and we are a dangerous species, because we hardly ever satisfied, isn't that so? You know, everybody walks out of the movies and that was awesome, and you didn't think so, because the producer forgot to edit that little bit properly, and those things didn't coincide, and the guy's watch, it was not true to the period, so they weren't wearing watches then. What? And nobody else would see that, but you would see that, because you're a bit of a perfectionist, and you're always reaching for the ideal, and generally you're ideological. You generally just need something to believe in, and it must feel worthy. And Christ represents that paragon of worthiness, a worthy ideal, a global mission or something. And so when it comes to the whole issue of hope, we're very different. You know, somebody who's at the end of his rope, at the end of his tether, comes to Christ. Any sliver of hope presented is wonderful. But the other lot, the hope junkies, you know, we're never quite present where we are. We're always reaching to something greater, you know. We're the guys who sit in conversation, and everybody's hosing themselves. They're laughing. And you're sitting there because you know you have a better story. And you preface your contribution with, wait, that's nothing. I have the telling contribution. You're going to love mine. And it's beautiful, you know, aspirational, full of ambitions and that. But, you know, people who aim high, you know what happens to us? We fall so hard, you know. And we sort of pick up the pieces. Then we say, well, at least I aim. And I fall higher than the next guy who doesn't aim at all. At least I fall on some hill and some mound, so and I still have a vantage point. I can look ahead again, and so we pick up ourselves and dust ourselves off, and we look ahead again. And all of us must deal with the issue of the flip side of hope. The flip side of hope is disappointment. I want us to look at that today, because it's one of those realities in life that we all must learn to negotiate, and for Christians that's really tough. And I want to speak especially to those of us that are drawn to the ideal. We go into life expecting sometimes too much out of any given situation, because our expectations aren't quite true. And for some people, it's really, really hard to make that transition out of the fantastic Disney kind of experience that we've idealized, that idealized existence. And I've been talking to the young people, actually fighting with them a little bit. I'm at UCT and Stellenbosch, you know, the people who feel the fees must fall and everything must be free. It's a dreadfully telling sign of the times that we live in, you know. It's really not an issue that has primarily anything to do with social justice on one level. It is, but in South Africa, goodness, you know, I was saying to them that we have millions of people that are unemployed, and the unemployment is not their big problem. It's the fact that they're unemployable. So what we need in South Africa desperately is a skills training program that is driven so aggressively as the number one priority in this nation. But we don't have a crisis at tertiary level, and especially at the university, we've seen the riots happening. They represent the upper reaches of social stratification in the world. I mean, most of the world is literate, and then there's a smaller percentage that are literate and numerate, and of that group, the top 2% would be at university. And when you are at Wits, Stellenbosch, and UCT, you comprise the top 2% of that 2%. So I just said to them, people, it's really so wrong to walk around feeling wounded by the big thing these days is microaggressions. Somebody doesn't look up to greet me when I walk into the room because I'm black or I'm fat or I'm tall or whatever. You know, so it works on my G so much that it induces this rage, and I'm entitled to expressing this rage in any which way I feel, because I'm entitled. And it's quite sad, an entitled generation. And obviously the weird thing is that what would seem conspiratorial, because exactly the same arguments are manifesting at Yale, in London, in Europe, as does at Fort Hare. And those people have never even been in contact on social media. There's no human agency that ties them together. It is profoundly prophetic, the things happening in the world today. You know, and over a weekend like this, I don't even think what happened in Kenya and what happened in Paris is connected by way of an orchestrated attack. It's just interesting times that we live in, very challenging times. And I believe it's times that Christ warned us about. The Apostle Paul warned of a generation that would come that would be essentially narcissistic. Leaders of countries around the world would be expressively narcissistic. They wouldn't give two hoots about a country or a nation. And it's pretty universal. Leaders of countries become movie stars, and when you watch sports games these days, the referees think they're the stars. It's just a very convoluted world. It's like we have generations of people who have just walked away from the whole notion of the joy and the pride of serving. You know, I don't know about you guys, but you know, it was so great growing up with parents. I was with some people receiving some ministry in Scotland, and it was a very challenging time for a man. The ladies would have loved it, because for a couple of days you've got to sit there talking about yourself, but not just in a random way. The two people dealing with me, all they want to do is they want to know, how does that make you feel? And then comes the big one, intermittently. You are angry, aren't you? That makes you really, really angry. And I go, no. I don't know how I feel, but I don't feel angry. No, you are angry. You should be angry. You know? And after a week of that, I felt a bit hot under the collar, and I said, have you ever heard of a man called Nelson Mandela? He was in jail for 27 years, and he came out there, and he's not angry. And they blushed a little bit. I said, well, there's a lot of them, his kind, where I come from. We don't just get angry about anything. we sort of take it on the chin, and we just live on. And yeah, when it comes to the whole issue of hope and all that, the fact is, like me, maybe you're not honest with yourself. Maybe you're not in touch with what goes on in there, because we can't afford to be, because we don't take the time out to explore that. Ladies are great in that way. I mean, they explore it all the time. If you ask a lady how you feel, it's like Christmas for her, you know? Because you've got to put your seatbelt on. There's a lot happening there. It's like having breakfast in the morning and saying, how was your night? You can do that to a guy and you'll get a whatever. But for a lady, you have no idea how much happens in a night. There are things that come and go, and a lot of things happen. A lot of life happens when they're just sleeping. It's amazing. It's wonderful to be so in touch with your inner world. It's very healthy, by the way. And ladies, I think I moved a little bit. It took a week and a half to get me just to begin to feel something. But, you know, the bad thing is that at some stage, your inner world starts talking to you, starts banging like hard at your consciousness, saying, I'm unhappy, and sometimes we don't quite know why. So I think it's important that we sometimes look at the negative things. Disappointment, to my mind, has a fourfold purpose, and we'll go to scripture now and see these things. I believe disappointment from God's side. Firstly, it comes by appointment. A lot of the bad things happening in our lives. Now, I know this is not popular to tell Christian audiences because we're meant to be motivational coaches if we want to make it onto television and have a wide following. We're not allowed to say these negative sounding things. That a lot of bad things aren't actually bad. They tend to be bad. They feel bad and smell bad and look bad, but they're not necessarily bad. Because we'll find out that they are divinely orchestrated. And then when things go wrong in our lives, the inevitable question, the whole apportioning of blame thing is the first response that comes up. Who's responsible for this, you know? And then the subconscious question is it God? And then good charismatic people say, no, it's the devil. And I tell you, when we get into eternity, one day we're going to spend a lot of time apologizing to him because he's not quite that responsible for all the bad things. But is it the devil or is it me? And the answer to all those three questions are yes. It's God sovereignly. The devil's always involved, and to a larger or lesser degree, it's our fumbling. We have a large role to play in disappointment when things go wrong. Okay, but disappointment has a fourfold purpose. I believe from God's side, it comes to reposition us, to realign us, to reshape us, and to refocus us. So let's just look at scripture, and then we'll have a look at a great icon of the faith, King David. King David was at the height of his success as a king. Things were going really well for him, but he was getting older, and he had learned to delegate quite well. He didn't do that quite well in the beginning of his reign, but toward the end, he was delegating. So every springtime, these days, we do sport, and we've just had the Rugby World Cup, and back in the day, it was pretty much the same, except that they didn't play with balls. It was like arrows and spears and that. So the winners didn't get trophies. They just walked home alive. No, really. Every springtime, nations would go to war to settle scores because they couldn't do it in winter. And if you were angry, you had to wait till springtime and then you get everybody mobilized and then you march. It was like that. Every empire only expanded once a year, not all the time, because you couldn't do it, you know, just logistical challenges. But in any case, so it was a time like that, and David had learned to delegate, and the army went out. Yeah, so he's a pretty out there, committed, hands-on leader. So when the guys are away, he was a little bit bored, and he got hooked on his big screen TV, and then he had these cameras around the palace, and the palace was elevated right in the middle of this city, and he could see through the backyards of everybody, and there was a rather dick lady, because dick ladies were very sexy back then. There was this dick lady who was having a bath, and he couldn't resist her. So, you know, he did the unthinkable. Yeah, he got her pregnant. And then he had her husband put down. And then he covered it up politically. Bad, bad, bad. All bad. All very bad. But now, the baby got born. And then the baby fell ill. And that's where we join the story. So David's prostrate, which means face down, spread eagled before God. He hasn't eaten or drunk for 7 days. He's just imploring God, please save this kid. Let this kid live. I know I was wrong. I blew it. I messed up. But please save the kid. So that's where we join the story. Then on the seventh day, the child died. David's advisors were afraid to tell him. They said he wouldn't listen to reason while the child was ill. what drastic thing will it do when we tell him the child is dead? When David saw them whispering, he realized what had happened. Is the child dead? He asked. Yes, they replied, he's dead. Then David got up from the ground, washed himself, put on lotions and changed his clothes. He went to the tabernacle and worshipped the Lord. After that, he returned to the palace and was served food and ate. His advisors were amazed. We don't understand you, they told him. While the child was still living, you wept and refused to eat. But now that the child's dead, you've stopped your mourning and are eating again. David replied, I fasted and wept while the child was alive, because I said, perhaps the Lord will be gracious to me and let the child live. But why should I fast when he's dead? Can I bring him back again? I will go to him one day, but he can't return to me. Then David comforted Bathsheba, his wife, and slept with her. And she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. And David named him Solomon. The Lord loved the child. A beautiful, beautiful narrative of disappointment. And for those of us with kids, you would know that disappointment doesn't come any worse than this. I mean, there was this beautiful moment on an Oprah show many years ago when there was a gentleman from Zimbabwe being interviewed by her, and Oprah was fascinated. Oprah said, so let me get this. You and your friend and your son, teenage son, on this little boat on a dam or on a lake in Zimbabwe fishing, and then you turn around and realize your kid's gone, and then you make a sum. You immediately, you know what happened. A crocodile snatched him, you know, pulled him off gently. And so the dad dove down, and there his son was being rolled. And this was Oprah's fascination. So you lost your arm in the process. He said, yes, I gave the crocodile my arm. He needed to have something. But once he had my arm, I could swim back up with my son. And she says, but isn't that a radical thing to do? He said, no, I'm a dad. That's what dads do. Any parent will do that for their kid. And you do it by instinct. You don't even think about it, you know. And he said, in fact, I'll do it again. He said, if my son were a drug addict, I'll have somebody pound my arm to bits with a big hammer if that would save him, if that would help him, because that's just where parents are at. You know, it's amazing what comes alive in your heart when you have this little person there. And, you know, they don't always look like you. Weird. You can only pray that they look better. Always pray for upgrades. I've got two upgrades who almost look like me. But, you know, at least there's some, there's some interview somewhere. And I tell you something, there's nothing in the world that you won't do for them. There's nothing at all. Nothing, 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 nothing. And so the thought of losing them, and, you know, in the ministry you get to do some difficult things. And, you know, sitting with parents with a kid who's just died or a kid who's disappeared or even a miscarriage, it's hard. It's bad. And then, you know, after that, people must get up and go on with life, and they must find their mojo, their hope, their faith again. They must go on. They must recover. Not everybody does. And sometimes even, you know, we deepen our faith and we know God and everything, but when the big hammer of life strikes, bang, you know, and we go down, and we all go down sometime. You know, it's not about the going down. Life is about the ability to bounce back up. You know, every boxer knows that. Sometimes you get blindsided. Sometimes a guy swings at you and you didn't see the blow coming and you go down. But the idea is that you come back before that countdown starts. Isn't that so? You know, so the guys stand there shaking themselves, and the reason you shake yourself is you know you need an adrenaline rush like right now. You started the bout with it, but now you need a second rush because you need to get back in the game like fast. And a lot of people just cannot shake themselves, you know. And yeah, family members and friends who come, just pull yourself together. And that sounds great in theory when you're not in the situation, isn't that so? So let me just run through, and there's so much that I can share, so hopefully we're not going to go so deep this morning, just so that we all can make a start somewhere. But David does something that is almost unconscionable for modern people. When the child is critical, he does not take to social media to tell the world about it. He doesn't go public. He's a very public figure. So, when it comes to disappointment, in terms of our response to it, a biblical response to it, is we must learn to hide. We must reposition ourselves. And especially us modern people, we have this weird notion that if calamity strikes, I've got to put myself out there, and then I'm going to get 1,000 likes, and after 1,000 remote pats on the back, I'm going to somehow feel better. And you know what happens? Nothing. And worse still, I talked to a lady from Europe the other day, and I said, I see you're not on social media anymore. What happened? No, I was in hospital, and I put it out there, and nobody liked the fact that I was in hospital. No, really. She said, nobody responded, and I realized I have no friends. And you know, that's like a pastoral moment right there where you just don't know what to say. You know, you like want to tell her, but you had no friends when you went onto Facebook. You don't go onto Facebook to find friends. You know, it's like reading You magazine. It's just something that you do. It doesn't add value to your life, doesn't add value to any. I was sitting next to a lady on a plane yesterday, and she looked like such a dignified, upstanding lady, and then she takes out this You magazine, and I line on. She spends as much time on the page with just ads on as the other pages. I was thinking, my goodness, what an amazing, she a focus. She reads that ad page as if it's the Bible. I mean, you know, you just do like furtive looks. Oh my gosh, this is deep, man. She enjoys. She gets a money's worth out of that thing. The whole flight. Eventually, she helped me to fall asleep. But you know, social media is like that. But we don't get it. We have this very weird notion that I'm going to find some comfort when I go public with my pain. And what David does, as we learn from his advisors, is deeply counter-instinctual. Humans have a need to run down the street. You know, in the Middle East, you still see it in Palestine. BBC loves to air the pain of the Arabs as if they're the only people who have pain. But in any case, but they have this habit of chest slapping and mourning and everything. In a lot of cultures, venting your pain in a public place seems to be the done thing. And that feels natural, but it's not the best way. A lot of the time, God allows calamity to strike so we can discover the secret place. We can learn to hide, you know. And there's a good reason for that. You know, pain forces us to a place of honesty and truthfulness that nothing else can. And the reason why we're running away from it is because we think a lot of distraction socially is going to be a great anesthetic. And it is, but only temporarily. But guess what? 2:30 in the morning, in the dark, doesn't matter if you've got 5 people in the bed next to you. When you wake up at 2:30 in the morning, you're alone with the pain. And so the idea is that, and you know, from our perspective, it may seem like, okay, God, that is like really wicked. I mean, and the whole issue of moral responsibility, who's responsible for what happens? Who should have saved this kid? Who could have? Okay, God could have. Why didn't he? That's the big question, you know? It's hard for us to accept the fact that he so desperately wants to invade our world. Because the easiest thing for us is to have a superficial religious relationship with him, much like a lot of cultures around the world. I'm going to bring him flowers and some food, and I'm going to leave it at the temple, then he should be happy. I'm going to appease him. And our God doesn't want appeasement. He doesn't need appeasement because he's not angry. He wants relationship, but he wants relationship by his definition, real relationship. You know, and it's so weird, it's so hard for us just to get it. That when we come together here this morning, like, we'll raise a hand. For some people,
even getting vulnerable before God to that extent of standing there in a hands up position. I mean, it's like big. I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to hands up to him. I don't hands up to anybody, you know. And I know that's hard for us to. People come to worship service like these, and you can tell who the newbies are. They look around like, who are they? Who are they looking at? Who are they waving at? You know, is the band? No, it can't be the band. The band looks the other way, and they've got their eyes shut. It's like a weird situation. It's like a rock concert. It sounds like it, but it doesn't look like it. It doesn't feel like it. It's just weird. You know, and for a lot of people, that's hard to sort of connect in a real way with an unseen God. And so God sometimes has to take the last resort route to break into our unseen world, our inner world, that world where we don't register feelings, or we think we don't, or anger, or pain. And he so badly wants us to come to the place where we have the freedom. Doesn't matter how broken and how crude and how awkward the moment feels. It's just so important that we understand why disappointment comes. He wants us to learn to articulate that pain. And articulate doesn't mean nice words or smart words. It just means your words. And doesn't matter how raw or clumsy, but he wants to hear it from you. He wants to hear from you that, gosh, God, I'm just shredded now. I'm just so broken, and I'm just so totally messed, and I'm so disappointed with you. It's how I feel. And you know, this is the thing, Christians. When it comes to God's relationship with us, and he's seeking intimate moments and intimacy with us generally, we've got to understand that God does not judge feelings. Because life does not judge your feelings. God created life. Life only judges your actions. That which emanates from feelings. And normally, actions that are, well, not positive or conducive or wise, many times comes from feelings that we've never worked through. Feelings that we don't face. People who do stupid things come across as stupid, but they're not stupid. It's many times just people have failed to exercise the courage to go and deal with the stuff that are really bugging them. You know, and that's why we pay a shrink so much money, so that they can help us dig down there. And God, actually, he doesn't want those people in our lives. He wants to be that person. He's the healer. But he can't heal a wound that we will not expose. You know, and there's something about our religious upbringing sometimes that says it's wrong. I can't tell him how I really feel, because he's going to think I'm unworthy. No, we were unworthy a long time ago. Nothing's going to make us more unworthy. But it's not like that from his perspective. You know, he's really interested in what happens down there. Because whenever disappointment strikes, you would notice that by the time you register that something negative is happening down there, you know what happens? And guys, it doesn't happen to women only. It happens to all of us. It's called, but never you never say like this to women. You never talk about overreaction. It's just not a safe thing to do. You never tell a woman you're overreacting. We don't go there. Because women cannot overreact. I'm not talking to you ladies. I'm talking to the guys. I'm just helping them. And you know the truth is, we all do that. We just do it in different ways at different times, you know. And I know for myself, I overreact by way of an implosion. I like going to the serious, big time sock. Let's hunker down, shut down. I'm not talking to God or anybody about this thing. I'm putting this thing away. I'm locking it away, and I'm fighting this one so deep. Never gonna go back there. Bad, bad, bad thing. And everybody around you knows that there's something wrong, but you're going to pick yourself up. You're going to pretend everything's fine. But we're overreacting just in different ways. But a lot of time when the disappointment comes, there's an explosion that isn't quite representative of what has just happened. By the time it manifests, it's the compounded pressure of a lot of stuff that are unresolved that now explodes, and people around you go like, what? You had two dates with him, and now you're wanting to slit your wrists, but you don't even know his surname. You know, like, what's going on? And you know, he just represents 20 guys who did the same thing, and I just cannot take this anymore. You know, but you're not going to say so. You're going to focus on that one thing because that's the immediate trigger of the pain. And God's looking at the situation like differently. He's looking at an open door, but the open door for us in a practical sense means that I've got to do something that modern people just so run away from. It's like to slow down and to go to hide, just to be quiet, just sit there until you can figure out what's going on inside, and then you begin to talk to him about it. And you know, people, you have no idea how much more therapeutic it is to a shrink who's not in the room. Because it sounds to somebody in the room like you're talking to yourself, and you're not. But when you put it out there, research has shown that, like 20 years ago, I came across this, that there were two communities, one in Spokane, just south of Washington in America, and another Portuguese community living elsewhere, that they were tough for medical practitioners because they didn't have medical doctors in their communities because the guys couldn't make a living. Too few people came to visit their rooms. And researchers got very, very fascinated by this. And it came down to the fact that these communities were confessional communities. They were Catholic. But once you've told the priest this, guess what? You go out there and you tell everybody else because you've said it. You put it out there. And that kept people healthy. Weird. And God is a jealous God. He so wants to be the first receiver of your pain. And then disappointment also brings a realignment. You know, disappointment has a social purpose too. And it has something to do with the fact that God sees your and my life as like a garden, and sometimes it needs pruning. Sometimes there come some people that needs to exit. It's like that Facebook moment for my German friend. And I don't think she's necessarily doing the right thing in terms of just expunging the account, closing it down, and going into a reaction that is strong. It's not an overreaction, it's a strong reaction. But you know, you've got to make a peace with the fact that when the pressure's on and the disappointment really strikes, and even if it was that boyfriend that you've only had two dates with, it is very easy then in your pain to assess what your world looks like. Because our world really comes down to the people, the significant others, the meaningful people in your world that contribute to your world. Isn't that so? And that is a painful thing, but let me tell you, that is a huge blessing. God wants us to realign. There's this beautiful scripture in Romans 5:5. I think it's there. A very odd thought in there. Now hope does not disappoint. And I don't know if you can see that, but that is usually problematic because it's not logical. Now hope does not disappoint. You cannot be disappointed if you don't have hope. The only way you can be disappointment is if you nurture hope. Isn't that so? So that's not logical. It lacks congruency. So why would Paul say something like that? But he qualifies. He understands that he's saying something that isn't at face value, it's not true. It's not a truism. He should say it the other way around. He should say, hope always disappoints. You know, people who stay in bed have very few disappointments. It's people who get out of bed and try to run the comrades. They get like halfway, and then they have a heart attack. And they go through all this trauma and crisis, and the guy who stayed in bed goes to the bathroom, goes to the kitchen, has his soda, goes back to bed, then he watches TV. There's very little disappointment in his life. But it's all these people who are always trying. Okay, so maybe the comrades was a bit much. Maybe we'll just have that walk around the block with the old ladies at the church. We'll start all over. And as soon as you go from walking to running, it happens again. You break an ankle or whatever. Hope always disappoints, except Paul says, because the love. And you know what he's saying? He's saying something that we say all the time. He says something like, friends never let you down. And you go like, what? But we know what is actually being said. We're making a distinction between true friends and friends that aren't really friends. They pretend friends. And so he's talking about an authentic hope versus a false hope. And what he's referring to, he says, there's something that looks and feels like hope. There's a lot of aspirational energy in our lives and in the world. And that's a dangerous thing because it lets us down. And so it's more than just a realignment with the people around us. It's a realignment with life and our connectedness with those people. And the hope they bring with them. You know, when your friends say, you can do the comrades, we're with you. And then you're lying there with the pipes up your nose. Ambulance came to collect you. And you know where they are. They're not there because they couldn't be there because they didn't run with you. You're just there with strangers. Now you're lying in hospital and it takes 3 days before they find out what happened to you. Because they weren't even there when the race was finished. They're waiting back at the pub for you to come and share your horror story or your big fish story. But there's this issue of hope that is only hope if it's tied to real love. And so there's a false hope and there's a false love and there are real relationships and relationships that aren't so authentic. And that's the value-based realignment. A lot of the times, the way we connect with the world around us, the way we connect with people around us has a lot to do with convenience. It feels right, and it's situationally convenient. And we easily and just gently go with the flow, and God sort of wants to put a stop sign in the road and says, I want you to change your gear. I want you to live life differently. But it's very hard for him to have that conversation with us because it feels good when it's good. And the only way he can expose that it's actually not good is through a crisis. Isn't that so? And the crisis comes and you've lost your baby and all your single friends come along and say, oh my goodness, we're praying for you. I know God will show you how you've sinned in your life and what caused the death of your baby. But you'll get it. And you go like, oh my hat. So you're Christian. You know how many people said like that? They're so afraid of church, they run away because they think all church people are goofy like that. You know, or you sitting there and you're battling your ninny off to have a child and somebody comes to you and says, we've just had triplets in the name of Jesus. We've had the miracle. And God's good to us. No, he's not good to you, but he's really good to us. And he's amazing. And he's a miracle working God. And you sit there and okay, I don't have a story to tell. And okay, so obviously God doesn't love me and miracles aren't for me. But you get what I'm saying. But you've suddenly got to realize that, okay, you're not a friend. Maybe you are a friend, but you're certainly not my friend. And I do need you now, but like a hole in the head. I can live without you very comfortably. And I want you to read the love of God in all this. There's a lot of disappointment that comes by way of our relationships and by the way people connect to us and we connect with them. And that's the major source of disappointment. Isn't that so? And some of us are so guilt-ridden. We false guilt junkies. It is so hard for us just to make the sums and to realize, okay, it's a sign. I must move on now. And it's not wrong. It's just good for me. It doesn't mean they're bad people. It doesn't mean that they're from the devil. It just means that we're not friends. Because you know your friends by their capacity to care. And God, and I tell you, it's better going through life with two people in your life that really care than to be Michael Jackson or Justin Bieber with millions who actually, you know, all they like is a little song that they have a moment with. But they don't really care about you. They don't know you. If they did, maybe they wouldn't want to hang around you at all. There's also the way we maybe let's just go to the next point. Realigning with God. Ambrose Bierce said, "The present is that part of eternity dividing the domain of disappointment from the domain of hope." And if we can go to the previous slide. Some of us... No. Realign with the God of the present. The slide just before that. There we go. For some of us, God is out there and not right here. And God wants us to realign the way we connect with Him. God so badly wants us to discover that He's present right here and now. And then if we can go to the next bullet, it's quite a few slides on. It has to do with reshaping. You know, the humbling thing, there we go. Can we go to the next slide? The humbling thing is what disappointment teaches me about myself. And that's what we see from the life of David too. You know, David looks around at his advisors and he realizes, okay, you're just here because I pay you salaries. You don't really care for me. And worse still, you don't know me. Because here, the real me is showing up. The real me isn't the guy running around raping women and carrying on. I don't know. You know, a lot of people have moments of madness and other people are happy to have them defined by a moment of madness. But you know, real friends and family who love you, they look beyond that. They can discern a moment of madness. And David's advisors are like, "Wow, David, we really think that you're a little bit crazy, you know? And we know, we've seen you in war situations. You cut people's heads off when you become emphatic about victory. You're not afraid of giants and people. You're a bad guy. So we're not going to share this bad news with you because it's going to be bad for our health." And that's not who David is at all. The guy who's king, who leads the army, he's got skills. And yes, on a good day, he will take you out. But the guy who's there on the floor, he's like such a teddy bear. He's the guy who writes poetry all the time. And he puts it to music. He sings it. When he's with God, he takes his lion, and that's who he really is. He functions in a lot of roles, but the people closest to him didn't really know who he was. And he couldn't discover that until that moment of bitter disappointment. Realized, man, I'm surrounded by idiots. I don't need these people in my life. But you know, the other thing that happens is, after you've looked at your friends, you're forced to look at yourself. And it's a tough thing I'm saying right now. But many times, the crisis is determined, the magnitude of the crisis is determined by how I view myself. If I'm very big, very big people have very big crises all the time. Small people have small crises. It's a humility issue. And you know, when you look at the students running around on campus today, they're really big people. I was saying to some of those little girls, you know, it's interesting when I talk to you guys. None of you have ever had problems with fees because you've all been to private schools and you come from very wealthy families. Most of you aren't even from South Africa at all. But you're running around raging. And I said to them, that's fine. But what I can tell you too, that this is Africa. And in Africa, when you march like that, there's a lot of national intelligence agents among you. And they're profiling you. And all I can tell you, you can have all the white kids protecting you from the police, but this is Africa. When the white kids aren't there, they'll come for you. Because you don't dishonor your elders. You don't go around on social media saying bad things about them, whether it's true or not, and think you're going to get away with it. The fact is, you're going to discover that maybe some people think you're too big for your boots. And there will be a repercussion. I'm your pastor, I've got to say it. I can't say you're courageous and brave. This is not a Caitlyn Jenner moment. This is real. This is you and I'm your pastor. And are you ready to deal with what's coming at you? It's fine to get up there and make your speeches and run around. But you know, when it's 3:30 in the morning, there's a banging on your door, and you open up, and there's a couple of really, really bad-looking guys standing there saying, come with us. Then you have a problem. Then you're forced to rethink this whole situation. Oh, my hat. It was so great when we were all marching and we were singing, bring my machine gun, you know. And let's kill all the whites. That felt so cool. It was such a powerful moment. But now, the reality check is a little bit cruel. But you know, it's so necessary. Disappointment brings a lot of wisdom. And it brings the challenge for us to embrace smallness, to embrace emptiness. And this is hard for Christians. It's hard for modern aspirational Christians. I get really nervous when I look at the television fare that Christians are served, and I'm not wanting to be critical. It's just so dangerous. You know, this whole humanistic I can because I've got it inside me. No, you don't have it inside you. We have the capacity to really mess things up for ourselves. You know, and if you really have it inside you, then maybe you don't need God, because maybe you're bigger than God. But all of us have those moments when life comes to visit. It doesn't matter how powerful we become, you know. It doesn't matter how much of a self-made man you have become. We have moments when life comes banging at the door and saying, so you're the big shot. So can you handle what's about to come now by yourself? Because your autonomy was always the most important value in your life. Let's see how you're going to handle this. And the amazing thing is that if we're willing to roll with the punches, and this is hard, to allow what is happening to speak to you, because sometimes we resist so hard that the pressure just it causes us to snap and break. A lot of people just snap and break. They never get up again. The scripture says so beautifully, humble yourself under the mighty hand of God so that he can pick you up, so that he can exalt you, you know? Don't let life cut you down. Just bend your knee. Just size down, you know? It feels so good to assume the defiant posture, you know? I'm going to overcome and I'm going to beat you and I'm going to smash you down because I can, because that's my calling. And it's very interesting to visit your friends who were there angry and raging with you when you were young, and you come back to them 20 years later and you see that there's nothing left of them. in this life and especially in eternity, only the small people survive. In God's kingdom, in God's economy, only the small people prosper, not the big ones. And if we can go to a few slides on. Relinquish spiritual ambition for a resignation to godliness. And you know what godliness is? Godliness just comes down to the golden rule. It comes down to love. And when disappointment comes, it comes down to a choice. I can get bitter or I can get better. And bitterness always means that I'm shutting my heart off to love. I'm going to stop caring because you don't touch me and get away with it. I can't eat back at you, but I tell you what I can do. I can close my heart. I will opt for indifference because that makes me feel better. Because I need to feel better. I need to feel good. And I tell you, humility is a gift that God brings to one. Some people have asked me in the past, so you came to Stellenbosch before South Africa changed and then, you know, followed what you thought God had told you to do. How did you do that? And I say, well, there were a lot of mountains that I had to move. And then they go, what were those mountains? And I say, well, they were all in my head. You know, God's not as interested in changing our world as he's interested in changing us. When we change, it's not like we respond differently to the world. The world responds differently to us. You know, it's weird. I was sharing it yesterday, our first holiday when we were in a ministry, we got invited down to Barberton, and it was AWB country and a lot of khaki clad people. I'll never forget waiting at the post office and this man in his diesel Mercedes with his arm out the window, and he had a massive tummy like stuck up against the steering wheel, and he didn't get out. He just waved at me and gave me like the double finger, and then he started driving down these dirt roads. Oh man. And I couldn't keep up with him. You won't believe how those people ride dirt roads. But some of my friends said, now you're out of the bubble. Now you're going to see what South Africa's like. It's bad, man, and you're not going to come back alive. Well, I came back after 2 weeks of being there, and we got a church planted there. We had a revival breakout. All those khaki-clad people came for brides every night to hear about Jesus. You know? And it's weird. I can tell you of that consistently, but, you know, it has something to do with just making the choice for smallness. All those big arrows fly right over your head. And God does it for our own sake. You know? So if you ask me, did I bring this on myself? Yes, a lot of it you did. But don't kill yourself over it. It's fine to be human and to be fallible. And you know how you fix that? Very easy. Just say, sorry. Help me. Your world's not going to fall apart. And you're not going to disappear. You're not going to vaporize. It's like we have an expectation of superhuman ability, and if we fail ourselves, we're not going to forgive ourselves. But I think it's so important that we learn to get over it. And finally, don't play God. Because big people love to talk like God. I'm never ever. And we make oaths and vows and decrees, and we legislate in the midst of your pain. Never make laws in the middle of your pain. Now, some governments do that. They get involved in the pain of the people, and then they issue these decrees and these laws, and they're always bad. You never make big decisions in the middle of a storm. Never. When you're in the middle of a storm, just focus on navigating the storm. Get out of there. But don't sit in the middle of the storm and project yourself out of the storm and say, when I'm out of this, this is going to change, that's going to... Don't do that. It feels right, but it's stupid. Because only once you're out of the storm, then you can look back and reassess. Isn't that so? But we only make big decisions when we're in a position to soberly assess or reassess. And so Scripture says, Christ says, listen, man, be small, live simply. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. And let the people around you know that when you say, I'm going to be there, it's fine. You don't need to do a 3-day fast and put it 10 times on social media that I've made a commitment to be there for you. Don't go overboard like that. Just chill. And get to a place where people know that when you make a commitment, they can bank on you, it's fine. Because that's just who you are. But I tell you, people who are like over the top in their commitment, like really effusive, just back off quietly. You know? It's a long story, but after all these years, I'm busy with the... I'm going to be making some pop music. I already started with Kensaltown Studios in London. They're really big. But in any case, so I'm there and I'm having a meeting with the producer and I say hi to Glenn, and then a Portuguese lady apparently. I say hi to her, and Glenn says meet whatever, Ambrosia, whatever her name is. The next thing, she runs at me and she jumps at me, both legs around my waist. And I'm being kissed, man. So I stand there like, okay. This is like an African moment here. And I'm looking to Glenn now, what does one do here? I mean, I've got a monkey on my tummy. You know, so we went on and had the meeting, and all I wanted to do was, now, is that how things work around here? I haven't been in these things for so long. What do I do? Do I hug back, kiss back? I don't know her. I'm an introvert, you know, I do like that if I don't know people, and if I really know you, I'll hug you or whatever, but I'm not comfortable with all this stuff, you know. But generally speaking, I mean, that's not a good sign. I don't care what the culture is. That is like a tsunami, man. This big, I love you to the ends of the world. You can't love me to the ends. You don't know me. You know, maybe it sounds cool and it's out there. But the point I'm making is that Christ says, I want you to stay away from the effusive. You know, the big thing I love about God in Scripture, and it's consistent. You've got to pick this up. He's got this thing about understatement. He never gets too excited. I love the creation account. God looked at everything and he said, it's good. And then he looks at man and he says, that's very good. And then he goes back to, it's good. A couple of times he says, it's good. You know, and that is consistent throughout Scripture. So when God says it's very bad, look out, man, he's like seriously upset. But God doesn't speak in those big effusive terms, you know, and Christ came into a Semitic culture where people beat their breasts and carry on when they're angry, and when they Mac and Odin, Mac's half Lebanese, and they did mission work and they were stationed in Cyprus, and they talk about sitting having coffee one day and two cars around the traffic circle, they collided and the drivers get out and then they begin to abuse each other's mothers and grandmothers, and they swing fists at each other and they're screaming at the top of their lungs, and Mac's not sure whether he should now call the cops or an ambulance. What does one do? There are no sirens. The two cars stand there steaming and these guys are going at each other. And while the two of them are still trying to decide, now, what is, we Christians, we missionaries in Cyprus, we must do something. You know, suddenly the guys look at each other, they reach out to each other, they hug and kiss on the cheeks, get back in their broken cars and they drive off. And they go like, what? That's just how it works over there. People have it out until they feel good and then they go on with life again. But our temptation is to not find our handbrake cable when the pain is there, and then we want to say stuff. All I'm saying this morning, people, don't. It's counter-instinctual, but don't. Just say nothing. Don't tell God, if you take this away, I'm going to do this and that for you. I'm going to sacrifice 3 children. I'm going to give you $10 million. Don't do that. Don't write checks that you don't have money in your account for. And finally,
And this is much probably the nicer part of the whole thing. Refocus. Disappointment comes to help us refocus. Thomas Hardy says, the sudden disappointment of a hope leaves a scar which the ultimate fulfillment of that hope never entirely removes. But you know something? Even though disappointment leaves a scar, those scars are good. The Apostle Paul goes on to say, to conclude, let no one give me any more trouble, because the scars I have show that I'm totally sold out to Christ, that I'm committed to Christ. You see, as we follow Christ, as we serve him, things happen, man. Things don't run according to schedule and according to script. Christianity is sometimes very hard for Americans, because Americans, they've got this amazing culture. I love American culture, but it's not Christian. You know, there's this Hollywood. Do you know that when Americans perform, generally, I don't know how the new generation does, but in my day, nobody will get up on stage and say anything that has not been scripted and rehearsed. So when we as South Africans come there, I was telling some friends the other day, years ago, I had this ambition of just driving an old Cadillac. So I found myself an old Cadillac, a dealer with some old Cadillacs there. And I just wanted to ask a salesman if I could take it around the block, you know, like my Elvis Presley moment. And the salesman came out. And then after a few seconds, we were sharing. And then he called these colleagues. And then I had to share with them. And then eventually the manager came and says, what are you doing out on the pavement? Then he had us all go inside, moved, made a space. And they had everybody sit down. We had church for the rest of the day. I didn't get near a Cadillac. And that happens to me time and time. And I've figured something out. You know, we as African people, and I cannot so much speak for the rest of Africa because I'm from Southern Africa, but we have a peculiar gift. You know, it's called generosity. We give of ourselves so easily. We don't even think about it, you know, which makes us spontaneous people. We are actually amazing innovators. Thank God for Elon Musk that helps the world to discover. You know, it's like a Mandela moment for us. Do anybody know Elon Musk? If you don't know Elon Musk, please get yourself a Google account. You know, he's providing the world with one of those quantum moments in technology. The world's about to change in the next 10 years. He's a little guy from Pretoria. But and Elon's story is so great, actually. He's a CEO, but he's got these great ideas, but he doesn't equate changing the world through technology with becoming a trillionaire. Because he's weird. He's unlike all the Americans. He's not like Steve Jobs, who wants to tie up every song and every copyright in the world and squeeze the life out of everybody else and keep all the money for himself, and then he dies. And I wasn't sad when that happened. But in any case, Elon Musk is amazing. He just takes a regular salary like everybody else. And he gets on with life. He's not one of these larger-than-life CEOs. Go and read up about him. But you know, we've got an incredible redemptive gift to give to the world. Because the reason why those guys gather on the pavement is not because I'm such a great speaker or anything. It's just because I'm happy to share without doing an offering. Americans don't get that. They're waiting for, okay, so what's in it for you? And the other thing is, we can wing it. We don't need a script. A friend of mine, he's so cute. He was a student, so he's working at one of those ski resorts. And he's just arrived there. He knows nothing, but, you know, he's here to make some money. He's a student, and he's from Stellenbosch, so. Peter. And he hears what the fees are for ski instructors. And he thinks, this is cool. And so at the first chance he gets, he makes himself available as a ski instructor. He's got a little problem. He's never skied in his life before. So while his first family's on his way to him, he's in the lift, and he tries to get his girlfriend on the phone because she skied before. He says, just give me tips, just four. That I can memorize. And he gets his four tips before these people come. And he's out there on his snowboard, because at least he can snowboard. And he's doing circles around them. And they say, but now, this is a ski instruction lesson, right? He says, yes. But You know, skis don't allow for the kind of mobility I enjoy now. So today you'll have your first lesson. And he made the first lesson of the first point he could remember stretch for as long as he could. And he became a very successful ski instructor without being able to ski. You know how most coaches don't swim or play rugby? And they win World Cups and all that. But only in South Africa. God sometimes brings us to a place where we learn how to wing it. But you know, when we do, we end up with a lot of scars to show for it. Because you crash sometimes and you burn. And when we do it for Christ, and this is the toughest part of following Christ. He wants everybody to get there. Yeah, Christ once, talking to an old man, he's a theologian, comes to see Christ furtively in the dead of night, and he says to Christ, how do I get this whole spiritual thing, this born-again thing? And Christ says, well, my man, you're going to have to learn to free up. I could tell by your body language when you came in, you're a little bit uptight. And he says, think of it this way, it's like the wind. The wind blowing through, you don't quite know where it comes from, where it goes. You can't get your head around it. But the bottom line is you must learn to be flexible. And that's scary. I don't know if you've skied before. I've tried in Switzerland. And, you know, I don't know. After a road trip with my boys, one day they sat me down. I've got two sons. And they said, Dad, you're not pretending. I said, what do you mean? They said, you're really black. You know, swimming, skiing, heights, a lot of things, depth, submarines. Oh, man. I didn't know it, but I have serious moments there. But, you know, until Christ says, I want you to do it, I want you to go out there, just walk on water. And that's when smallness helps. But the point I'm wanting to make, as we close, is that, you know, every time we pick up a scar, it's a bit of a badge of honor. That's how God thinks of it. And we tend to fall into this, oh my goodness, that was so bad, man. I'm not going to go back there. Paul says, it's not like I go back there. People, I want you to go back there because I'm going to talk about it. I'm going to talk about my tough times. I'm going to talk about when I messed up. I'm going to talk about when I had a mad moment. If you're David, I mean, young men, don't have a mad moment like me. When you get to close to retirement age and you have this existential crisis and out there, and then you find yourself doing stupid things. It happens to older men. So please, when you get there, get yourself a mentor and talk through these things before you do wild things, okay? And what he's doing is he's brandishing his scar. I've got a scar to show for this, and you know it's going to benefit you. Can we stand this morning? And you know why that focus is important? Is because when you're a believer, the weird thing is, people don't watch Christians when they win, because sometimes we don't do that all that often, contrary to what the American television evangelist would say. But you know, when people really have an encounter with God, it's like when Christ is hanging on the cross. He's been hanging there for a while, he's bleeding, and he's like really messed. He's been seriously injured. And then there's this moment where he demonstrates an empathy that still blows our mind. He can barely speak, but he's going to speak redemption over us. He says, Father, I want you to forgive them. Father, I'm so thinking of them. And Father, they're such idiots, but please have mercy on them because they are that. That's the only reason why they're doing this to me. It's not because they're bad people. It's just because they're very poverty-stricken when it comes to sensibility sometimes. They get emotional. They get carried away. Please forgive them. And you know, as that happens, Scripture says there's an officer of the Roman army and he's watching all of this. And suddenly it strikes him that there's a God
Because it's in that vulnerable moment that he realizes that there's a power much greater than the aspirational one that is Rome. There's a dynamic that he's missed. It's so easy to miss it. Until you're there and you watch the Son of God lose. Until you watch the Son of God walk from the Garden of Gethsemane and he's in that place and for once heaven's quiet. He says, God, I'm going through hell right now. Watch me, I'm bleeding. I'm sweating blood here. And you know what the Father says? Nothing, nothing. And then he gets messed around. He's got to carry his cross all the way, the Via Dolorosa and all that. And he hangs there. And no angels come to rescue him. There's no Rambo moment. Nothing. And then the power mongers of this world, they watch him and they realize. Do you know that is happening all around the world at the moment? Muslims turning to Christ. We had it in Iraq just a while ago. These Egyptian friends of friends on the beach, not afraid, getting beheaded. And they're singing all the while. It's caused a massive turnaround in Egypt. The gospel message I'm sharing with you this morning, I believe, is the gospel message. But it's not one that we hear often. But it's about the power of the cross. Christians don't run away from pain, starting with their own pain. We don't run away from it. We go through it. We go to God. We get small. We hide. We talk it through with Him. We have Christ shepherd us through the valley of the shadow of death, where we're literally going through our hell. And we stay there until He brings us to the high place of vindication, where we have dinner with the Father. And then once we're whole, we walk right back in there, because then we've come out of that situation with an empathy for people. We can spot people that are in their hell. And it's the most beautiful thing when you walk into a room and you can look around and you can within seconds see the people that are in the place that you were or that you are. I'm so blessed for my scars because it helps me to see people that are in the place where they are sustaining those scars. And you can walk right into their situation, just be there for them. And it's not be there with like a false hope, like I'm going to pray for you, I'm going to fix everything, it's all going to go away. No, no. I've been there and I come through this. And I can help you come through this because I know somebody can help you come through this. It's not magic. And thank God for the times that the magic happens. God does amazing stuff.